Well, good day, everyone, and welcome to the Publishing Business Virtual Conference and Expo, or welcome back if you've already joined us for earlier parts of the program. My name is Chris Keneally. I'll be the moderator for this session. Looking forward to it. I am Director of Business Development and Author Relations at the nonprofit Copyright Clearance Center. We're online at copyright.com. And on behalf of Book Business Magazine and the Publishing Business Virtual Event, I'm very pleased to have you join us for another great live session, DRM, the Do's, Don'ts, and Profitable Strategies for Digital Rights Management. Some things we need to mention with regard to the technology you have in front of you today. Before we get started, just a few quick tips that should help you make the most of today's live webinar. First, if you have any technical difficulties, you can troubleshoot by clicking on the Help widget at the bottom of the console marked with a question mark, or let us know via the Q&A box. You can also use the Q&A box to submit your questions to today's panelists. We'll address those select questions at the end of the presentations, but you can, of course, send us your questions at any time. Please make sure you turn off any pop-up blockers on your computer so that you can utilize all of those great widgets and bells and whistles. Speaking of bells and whistles, as we have been throughout this right now, please click on the Tips for Attendees widget to learn what all of the widgets on the console can do and how you can customize your experience today. You can even tweet right from the console. So we do hope you'll help share this with your followers. Lastly, if you have to leave the session at any time or would like to view it again later, you can access the entire presentation from the auditorium in the Publishing Business Virtual On-Demand Environment, which will be open for 3 months beginning next Monday, October 31st. So with all of that, again, welcome to our program, DRM, the Do's, Don'ts, and Profitable Strategies for Digital Rights Management. We have two panelists joining us today. I want to welcome to the program Andrew Brenneman. Andrew, welcome.
Great to be here, Chris.
Well, we're delighted to have you join us. We'll tell people that you are the founder and president of Finitiv Corporation. And since 2008, Finitiv has created and executed digital publishing strategy through the delivery of consulting and technology services. Next year, 2012, Finitiv plans the launch of a family of cloud services that will provide publishers with new transformative capabilities. The cloud is something we've been hearing a lot about, and we'll hear more about it from Andrew, who has been leading digital media initiatives for over 25 years within publishing organizations and technology organizations. And some of the initiatives he's led are the Chicago Manual of Style Online, Thompson Learning's Web Tutor, Microsoft's MS Dewey viral campaign, and so forth. Andrew holds a master's degree in technology and communications from New York University. He's got several U.S. patents for digital media innovation, and you may know him as a monthly columnist in the Digital Directions column for Book Business Magazine. Andrew, again, we look forward to your program. But first, we're going to turn to Christoph Brehm. Christoph, welcome to our program.
Thank you, Chris, for having me.
Well, we're delighted again to have you join us. Last time we saw you was actually at the Publishing Business Real Conference and Expo. By that I mean the one where everyone is there in person in New York City. But it's great to have you on this virtual one. Christoph Brehm is Vice President at Attributor, managing their global sales effort. Attributor is a solution provider for the publishing industry, focusing on piracy solutions and business intelligence. Christoph will tell us a good deal more about Attributor in just a moment. After obtaining his MBA from the University of Washington in Seattle, Christoph has been working with technology companies for the last 12 years, addressing business problems with innovative solutions. In his prior career at Ernst & Young Management Consulting, he learned that technology is not the only answer to most problems, in spite of what we are often told. He says it requires the addition of a best practice process with the right resources. That's a concept that Attributor very much follows today to combat piracy and turn consumers into customers. Well, with that, Christoph, again, welcome to the program, and we want to get started here. And you make the point, as you did with me at the expo and just there in the introduction, that there is an important relationship between technology and publishing. And if you will, kind of give us your thoughts on that and tell us some more about Attributor.
Yeah, great. Again, thank you, Chris, for the introduction, and hello to everybody. Thank you for joining this conference this afternoon or morning, wherever you are. Before I get into talking more about DRM and what we think about DRM and how it can help you protect your content or not, I want to tell you just a little bit more about Attributor, so just to set the right context and understand where I'm coming from. Attributor is a technology company. It's really headquartered in Silicon Valley with offices around the world. But what really makes us different, and Chris was alluding to it in the introduction my person, that we're not only looking at technology. That really makes us a little bit different from a typical Silicon Valley outfits. That we also understand that there is a workflow, a process, and sometimes, but always, also human interaction necessary to get the best results. And this is really what we apply to our solutions, which includes anti-piracy solutions following the Digital Millennium Copyrights Act, the DMCA process, and other global legislation. As you can see in this slide on right now, we have north of 200,000 books under management at this point, and we send more than 4,000 takedowns per day today to remove infringement files from the web. That's really a number that, for one, it's growing tremendously, just like piracy is growing on the web. But it also shows that piracy is rampant, and I want to provide a little bit more background on that in the upcoming slides.
Right, and I should say, Christoph, that takedown rate, that 98% success rate, is an important figure to kind of highlight, isn't it?
Very much so, very much so. And that's really, it goes to the point that we're trying to make also in this presentation and in this discussion, is how to best protect your content. And DRM might or might not have had success in various instances, but what's really important is if a content leaks on the web, what are we best going to do about it within the current framework of legislation? And the Digital Millennium Copyrights Act gives us some leverage there and finding the content and removing it. And what's really the benchmark here is how effective we are in removing that content. And then 98% is really a number that a lot of and most publishers can live with. Still, we would all like to see 100%. It's just like a whack-a-mole game. And the new sites are popping up, and we're a little bit like viruses companies almost for your PC.
Right, absolutely. And I think, though, that 98% is just, I would say a higher number than I would have thought, because you would think that it would just be very hard to get all this down, but it's a great success rate. You know, you're going to talk about DRM as Attributor sees it, but I think it's worth to take a moment to kind of talk about what digital rights management has meant to some people. Can you give us a very brief, your thoughts? Because the definition has changed over time, hasn't it?
Right. The term has been around since the mid-90s, and somewhere around 95, 96. And initially it was really meant to be what we understand under it. It's a broad brush term for enforcement and control of your content. As of late, and what most people use DRM for is a very technical solution that restricts your content to a specific platform or a specific device. And this is really what the issue is. And when I talk about DRM, and forgive me for using a not-so-correct term, but I always use it in the same context. I use it as a technology solution to limit the distribution of content. And as such, whether a publisher thinks that's sufficient if they distribute only to a certain device or on a certain platform, that's one thing. But frankly, we just don't think it's effective because very simply, it's hacked very easily and content leaks out. And as soon as you have just one copy of your content out, it proliferates tremendously. However, when you consider DRM as a strategic tool and part of a workflow to control the syndication and distribution of your content, then it is a very successful strategy. But again, DRM can mean a lot of different things. DRM is much more a workflow, a process, and a strategy than it is an individual technology solution. And that's how we look at it.
Right.
And maybe to illustrate that a little bit more, do you want to make another point, Chris?
Yep.
Okay. So maybe to illustrate this a little bit more, I have a good slide that highlights the book piracy ecosystem, and that really, I think, is the best way to depict and show what we mean by that. When you look at the standard distribution of your content on the top half, kind of from left to right, the supply side, obviously, as a publisher, you go through your standard distribution channels to reach your customer. You know, that there might be online portals, Amazon, iTunes, some brick-and-mortar stores, Barnes & Noble and others. That's how usually an ideally distribution is happening. But there is the whole gray area of book distribution, and that goes then on the supply side to various roles within the piracy ecosystem. There's people who place content on the web. There's people who refine content on the web, which means they change many headlines, they change content, they change individual letters, so it's more difficult for search engines to find it. Then, of course, there's hackers. If you want to crack a DRM, just Google it, and you will find a solution for it, just like there is for almost any other technical solution or protection mechanism that is out there. And then there's also what we call posters, people that promote pirated content or infringed content on the web, people that use feeder pages, which are links that lead to certain files, people that write in blogs about it. That's actually a very popular methodology and technology today for methodology for pirates to hide content. They upload files that can't be described at all, they're just alphanumeric strings. But somewhere in a blog, in a forum, or in a feeder page to write about it, they provide a link to find that content. It just makes it more difficult for search engines or Google Alerts or anything like that to pick up that content, but only with the triangulation over the feeder page you can find it. So that's really how the supply side is working on the piracy ecosystem today. And then you have this large amount of unauthorized distribution channels. And by unauthorized, I don't necessarily mean that these are illegal sites. Most of these sites actually have legitimate business purposes. They are file-sharing sites. They are sites that allow companies, organizations to share files, to share individuals, to share photos and other things. They're just used by file-sharers for all other types of content. And in a way, what the DMCA, the legislation, gets right is that these sites can't necessarily understand what is infringed content and what is not, because they have no comparison to originals, and they have millions and millions of pages uploaded every day. So, yes, indeed, in a certain way, it is difficult for them to understand what is pirated content and what's not. But what the DMCA says is, if you do upload, if you identify infringed content on your site, and if somebody testifies that it is so, then you need to remove it. And that really then goes to the demand side, is who is actually reading this content. And you know, in the music industry and a lot of other talks about, or the movie industry, we a lot of times identify the demand side as these criminals who never want to pay for content. The good thing that the publishing industry has going for itself, and again, that's proven by a lot of consulting firm, and as a consultancy in the UK called Wiggins that has shown that as well, is that the demographics of book piracy and publishing piracy are a little bit different. You have a lot of what we call casual infringers or intentional infringers. So casual infringers are people that a lot of times do it not knowingly. You know, you find sometimes even a pay site where you buy content, and even you think when you buy it, you did something legitimate, but it's not. Sometimes you just have download links on sites that really have legitimate business purposes. And again, same thing, you think it's a legitimate site, so the content must be legitimate. And then there's what we call intentional infringers, you know, what college students a lot of times or groups like that are very well known for, is that they do it as long as they don't get caught or as long as it's very easy to do. Again, maybe a little comparison to the music industry. Before iTunes came around, I think a lot of people pirated music just because there was no feasible alternative. I had to buy a CD for $15 even if I only liked one song, right? And then iTunes came around and offered 99-cent songs, and all of a sudden some of these infringers that knew it was not right became legitimate customers. I mean, I want to stop the parallel to the music industry there, but those are just examples of people that if you tap them on the shoulder, if you provide less alternative for free downloads of content, they can be converted into real customers.
Well, I can say that we certainly understand that at Copyright Clearance Center. What we recognize, first of all, is the point that not everybody really understands what copyright law is about, so they think sometimes the ownership of some content means they can do whatever they want with it. Not true, of course. And then, secondly, to your point about making things easy, if you want to do it the right way, it should be the easy way. We've learned that lesson with some of the things that we do as well. We are talking with Christoph Brehm, Vice President at Attributor, who's telling us about the book piracy ecosystem for a program here on the do's and don'ts of DRM. And Christoph, you've got some numbers in terms of what the reality is for publishers out there as part of all of the ecosystem you just described. Why don't you show us that
slide? Right, Sure. Yeah, I mean, as you can imagine, having that many titles under management and looking for pirated content every day, we scan about 100 million pages per day. You can imagine we collect a lot of data. I just want to extract some of the information that we have and highlight to the audience some of this data. On the supply side, again, just to take some of these statistics, we ran a trial last year where we took 1,000 random titles across various genres in the publishing industry just to see how big the extent of piracy is. And again, this was January of last year, so almost 2 years ago when a lot of the tablets were not out yet, when the iPad was not as big as it is today, and when just the access to content was still a bit more difficult than it is today. And even back then, we found 9 million copies just for 1,000 selected titles. On the demand side, on the other hand, you know, one of the biggest questions people always have is how many people actually download those files, because you know how many links are out there, but the question is always how many are actually downloading it. And in order to get an idea of that, we took the Amazon top 90 titles. So again, Amazon top books, we took the first 90 titles in that list. And we've placed fake ads on Google and bought Google ad keywords to see how many people would click on an ad if it's easily available, right? Somebody's looking for a title, like a Dan Brown Lost Symbol title, and then an ad pops up, oh, download here for free. How many people would click on that? We monitored it for 30 days, and every day between 1.5 and 3 million people would click on those links.
I guess I'm not surprised, Christoph.
So let alone that people, that many people look for these 90 titles every day, right? But then when they get a place, an ad in front of them, you can imagine that probably the majority of the people click on it. Whether they download it in the end is a different story, but it's the demand is certainly there if you just provide easy access to it. And that really then it goes back to the point of DRM or not DRM. Again, if I look at DRM as a comprehensive solution in order to remove content from the web, yes, if you look for a technical solution, if only one copy leaks out onto the web, it's proliferated very easily and very quickly. There's also a story of a book that happened a bit over a year ago when a librarian got a pre-read copy of an anticipated bestseller, took it home, left it in the office. The 12-year-old kid found it in the office, took it to his scanner, scanned the book, and within a few hours, the book was available in four different formats on the web. So again, you know, I'm not even talking about DRM solutions. That's a physical copy, but it goes very, very quickly, and it proliferates very fast. So a DRM can only be a small part of a solution in a technical sense.
Right, and some great numbers there to kind of put some meat to the idea that this is a serious problem, and it's a problem that your research has shown occurs across all price points. It's not just the lower end, but also at the higher end.
Right, and that's another point that goes to the DRM discussion, right? Because there's some people that say, well, should I only protect my high-value content with DRM? You know, DRM costs money. I need to put an infrastructure in place. And you think, well, you know, $5, $10 titles, people wouldn't really pirate anyways because it's so inexpensive. But our research had shown that it's not. It really occurs across all price points with a certain sweet spot between $10 and $30. But no matter where you go, there's just no range where there's no infringement. And that's, again, why a more comprehensive solution is required. And a final statistic I just want to share with everybody is also the role how content is distributed today. And, you know, again, with the music industry, having Napster and LimeWire, some of these peer-to-peer networks being the most popular file-sharing places, that has shifted dramatically for the publishing industry. And one of the big reasons is that with tablets and iPads and e-readers that you carry around town and on travel connected to a 3G or a Wi-Fi network, very unlikely that you will download a piece of software that connects it to other iPads or computers, at least at this point, to create this network that a torrent or a peer-to-peer network requires. Instead, you go on a browser, Safari, Chrome, whatever browser you're using, and you search for a title, and the first link that comes up is Amazon, the second Barnes & Noble, the third is Foreshared with a free download of the same copy. So what is the propensity of using that is, of course, very high. And so we have seen that for one, the file sharing is moved away from P2P sites, at least for the publishing industry. I cannot talk for the other industries. Away from the P2P sites to less than 10% on the P2P sites, all to file sharing sites and cyber lockers. At the same time, some of the top file sharing sites, and now I have listed the top four here, those accounted for more than 80% of file sharing traffic for publishing just over a year ago. It has now been reduced to 53%. And while a year ago we only searched on 25 cyber lockers for content, we today search on over 5,000. So again, a whack-a-mole game. You shut down one, or you try to shut down one, and 10 others pop up. So to stay on top of that becomes a very, very difficult game.
Yeah, quite a challenge. And you're going to tell us then about the processes a tributor sees it to combat piracy. It moves across several different stages. Why don't you show us that slide?
Sure. And this is really how we see DRM in its wide sense working the best. It's very simply that you need to find the content. You need to verify that indeed is infringement. And finally, you need to do something about this. And that is really the key aspect to the solution. So on the detection side, you have a big internet, right? You have billions of pages. So how do you find that content? Again, Google, as good as it is as a search engine, it's not built to find published content, especially if it's hidden in numeric string files. At the same time, when you find the content, then, you know, think about a standard Google search. You do a look for something, and you get 5,000 results. Which ones are really relevant? You bet on it that Google finds you the first two pages that are relevant. But again, for publishing, that might not be the case. So you need to sort through a lot of results to get to a reasonable amount of results that are actionable and that are the most important ones to your business. And once you do that, then you need to do something about it. And again, removing is the most standard process, the Digital Millennium Copyrights Act, the EU Copyright Directive, and other legislation around the world allows you to simply write to those file sharing sites and ask them to remove the content. And by now, we have gotten so popular in quotes amongst those file sharing sites that they give us direct access to their hosting that some of these sites allow us to directly remove their content. So that's the most standard way. But then there's also other ways, and depending on local legislation or on what your intention is, you know, Europe, for example, if news content is reused, they don't send them a takedown notice, they send them an invoice for past usage. So you can directly monetize your content, and frankly, it is a revenue generator for newspapers in Germany. You also might find partnering opportunities, and I'll show you an example in a couple slides. But you might find somebody using your content that is very interested in it, and when you write to them to remove it, they say, well, I didn't know, I'm not supposed to use it, but I'm very interested in using your content. Can I become a licensee? So this is how we approach the solution, and this is how technology is built. And again, as part of it is the technology to crawl the web for the content. But then in the verification part, there's always a human interaction where we need to verify whether indeed it is infringement what we're finding, and also make sure we apply the right rules for every publisher depending on who we find as being the infringing party. And those are really some of the key aspects of our solution. And just to highlight some results for you, and just a couple slides before I'll hand it over, is on a book side, you know, one of our clients has been a client for over 2 years now, is applying our process, spending good chunks of money with us, so hence they needed to find out what the return on their investment is. So they looked at some of the textbook titles, or 21 textbook titles, second-year editions, before and after protection. And I found on 19 out of 21 titles a 500% increase in revenue, but that was straight decline before. So again, all it says is this process works. And you possibly can say this in a very limited fashion. It's just a DRM as a technology solution, but as an overall framework with a comprehensive workflow and protecting your content, it works for the book industry. And at the same time for the news industry, when we look at another statistic, we have, in the news industry, takedowns don't make as much sense as you can imagine because news is outdated very quickly. So instead, we send courtesy notices. We say, hey, we have seen you using our content. Please, you know, don't do this again. Or if you're interested in licensing our content, please contact us. And we found 44% of this sample of 1,465 notices, 44% responded with a note that they're interested in licensing their content. So again, even if only half of those eventually become licensees, it's a strong return on investment for customers and for using a process such as ours.
Right, and it really does seem like, I'm sorry, Christoph, it really does seem like significant dollars are being left on the table if you don't make some effort in this regard.
Correct. And so if you only look at as a supplies solution with using technical DRM to restrict it to a platform, you have still no control over distribution of illegal content. And then if you don't have that, then as a next step, of course you don't have an opportunity to convert these consumers into customers. Again, they're all consumers of your content. Some of them are just not customers. And that's really the objective of the solution that we are proposing.
Well, interesting perspective on the do's and don'ts of DRM with Christoph Brehm. Christoph is Vice President at Attributor, talking with us today from New York City, the company based in Silicon Valley, as you mentioned, with offices around the world. There's his contact information there if you want to be in touch with him. I have more questions about Attributor. I'm sure he'd be happy to hear from you. My name is Chris Keneally, Director of Business Development for Copyright Clearance Center. Very happy to have you on our program today as part of the Publishing Business Virtual Expo. If you do have a question, we invite you to send them into the chat box, and we'll be getting to all of those following our next presentation, which is going to be coming to us actually from Silicon Valley, from Andrew Brenneman at Finitiv.
Thanks very much, Chris.
Andrew, great to have you back. We should just remind people that you are, as I say, the founder and president of Finitiv Corporation, which is specializing in digital publishing strategy. And I understand in 2012, just next year, you'll be launching a family of cloud services for publishers. And you're here to talk about the cloud and the implications for the cloud or for DRM that the cloud presents. So tell us more.
Yeah, that's right. Well, we work with publishers. We're not on the distribution side or the commerce side. We work directly with publishers to maximize their opportunities in our delivery of consulting services and product development. One of the most significant issues that we and our clients have been exploring over the past at least year is to understand how cloud-based media delivery is going to change the landscape. And we do feel that it will be a watershed event in terms of changing the publishing landscape, and we are just at the beginning phases of that. We feel there's great opportunity for publishers in cloud-based delivery, not just in creating new value through new types of products and services, but also in having higher levels of profitability for their publishing initiatives. First, I think I'd like to define how I'm referring to cloud-based delivery today.
Thank you, Andrew, because you know what? I was just thinking there might be a few people in our audience today who get a little cloudy about cloud, and I think it's worthwhile to stop for just a moment and give us the bumper sticker on that.
Well, I think essentially, at its most essential, cloud simply means there's a remote server that is providing content or functionality. I mean, if you really think about it, CompuServe online service, where I got my feet wet years and years ago, was a cloud. That's in the broadest sense. What I'm referring to here in terms of cloud-based publishing is a product configuration in which content is primarily stored on a server, which is a device other than the one on which it is displayed. In other words, instead of downloading a book to a device and reading it, it is coming primarily from a remote server. Perhaps the best way of talking about what it is reviewing the alternative, which is
sort of
what we have today.
That's right. Andrew Brenneman, tell us. So the existing model for distributing content looks like your slide there, but tell us more.
You can refer to it as the e-commerce model or the e-book model, if you will. And we're familiar with that from iTunes or Kindle, et cetera. And, there's a server here to be sure. So in a sense, there is a cloud, but the cloud is used as a bookstore, and the product, the ebook, or the MP3 music file is transferred to a mobile device. And the flow looks something like this. The product is purchased, within an e-commerce environment. In reality, the customer is not really purchasing the product. The customer is buying a license that provides certain usage capabilities for a certain period of time. Typically, it's the use of this ebook in the manner in which the distributor, such as Amazon, allows on certain devices. A copy of the license is created and is maintained in the store. So that's important to keep in mind. We'll see that later on. So the fact that Chris went in and bought a title for his Kindle device is maintained as a record persistently within the ebook store. When he purchases the product, the license is created and download is enabled. The data comprising the ebook or the digital media is then downloaded to one or more devices and stored there. These are local copies that are stored in the actual device's storage capability. These, the ebooks, the data, is secured with some device-based DRM. And I think Christoph's introduction was a perfect background to this. In effect, there's a lock on the data. And the key to that lock is a license. And that license may be maintained on the device, but in addition to that, the device may need to communicate with the server's copy of the license to make sure the usage is okay.
I was going to say, Andrew Brenneman, that there's an interesting sort of philosophical question there, particularly in the book world, where in the real space you bought a book, you had the book itself. In the e-space, you've got a license to read the book, something else entirely.
Yes, and I have to admit that I'm not on the legal side of this thing, but I believe that one could make the argument that the purchase of a physical book is likewise somewhat like a license in that while you do have possession of the object, you cannot, for example, copy and distribute it necessarily outside of fair use.
True.
There are terms associated with physical books.
Right. Indeed. But under this model that you've just been describing, Andrew, there's some attributes to it, and you've kind of done a pretty careful analysis that kind of outlines for us how the e-commerce model has implications for DRM. Why don't you show us that slide?
Yeah, and I hope I'm not stating the obvious, but I'd like to tease this out because it's going to really set the contrast with cloud-based delivery. We have a single purchase event, typically. You buy a book. It is not a recurring revenue model. The license is maintained on the server to support authentication on multiple devices. The content is stored on a device. Your e-books are loaded to local storage on one or more devices. So there is multiple device to support, but you have multiple storage locations. This can create a lot of complexity when it comes to updating content, should that ever happen. So, for example, let's say a distribution channel such as Kindle allows up to 5 copies of your content in multiple types of mobile devices. Your book now sits on all of those devices. Now, let's say you have 3 such channels, Apple, Amazon, Google, for example. Now you've got many, many different formats of your book on devices out there in the outside world in a very distributed fashion, difficult to manage. Updates are very complex. What if you want to do a revision of that? Well, different distributors are going to support different revision schemes. It's a real headache. That's a problem. Now, in terms of the DRM implications, I think they're significant because there's a single point of failure. Your product is that ebook. The user of that ebook has that data completely in their possession. And the only thing protecting you from that ebook going out on Pirate Bay or some other site like that is that lock. You break the lock and it's out. Your whole product is there. Now, locks can be strong, and there are solutions like Attributor that can help you police piracy, but nonetheless, it's fairly simple to pirate. And we'll see how that contrasts with cloud-based delivery in a minute. From business implications, it's easy to understand the ebook e-commerce model because it's most like selling a physical book. You go to a store, you buy a book. You go to an ebook store, you buy an ebook and download it. It's very similar from a P&L perspective. Now, while there's a single revenue event, there is ongoing cost. There is, albeit minimal, cost in maintaining a server to manage these licenses so that the mobile devices can occasionally talk to a license server to say, I'm okay. There may also be costs, operational costs and service costs, in protecting those titles. So there's ongoing costs to support an ebook, even though you've only made money once. So theoretically speaking, the longer your ebook is out there, the lower your gross margin because you're continuing to spend in supporting that title. You can see why we want to move into a model in which we have recurring revenue to support these recurring costs. Final point I want to make in terms of this is, we've touched on this a little bit already, is that there's certainly customer backlash in certain types of copy protection and device-based DRM.
Absolutely.
Within this model.
Yeah, well, we're about to go into the clouds with Andrew Brenneman telling us about the DR implications for the emerging cloud model of delivery of content. My name's Chris Keneally. You're part of today's program, DRM, the Do's, Don'ts, and Profitable Strategies for Digital Rights Management, part of the Publishing Business Virtual Expo. And we'll remind people that if you have a question for either of our presenters today, Christoph Brem from Attributor or Andrew Brenneman, you can use the chat box, and we will see all those questions, and we'll get to them just at the end of Andrew's presentation. So Andrew, tell us then how what you've just described is going to be changed or affected by the emergence of the cloud.
Certainly. Again, I don't think the ebook e-commerce model is going to go away. It works for many market segments. It'll continue to be an important tool in the arsenal of the digital publisher. But I think there's another paradigm that needs to be explored and understood, and in many markets, perhaps not all, but in many markets, leveraged to the benefit of the publisher. In the cloud subscription model, which I'm referring to, the content stays on the server for the most part. And I'll get back to that for the most part in a minute. But the content remains in the cloud, and it's accessed from mobile devices, typically through a native application, but it could also be a browser. The ability for the content to remain in the cloud allows publishers to create subscription-based offerings. If the content is updated with some regularity, that is more attractive than an ebook model. If you are in the professional information, reference, or education market, quite often customers are looking for a set of titles to allow them to perform a job function. And this multi-title subscription-based product offering can be supported from the cloud. When a customer, quote-unquote, buys content, they are not buying a digital object like an ebook. They're buying access. They're buying the ability to enter into a service where they have access to content and to use any of the content within their subscription. Obviously, we can be looking at multiple devices that are accessing the same content in the cloud, and it is displayed in a way that is native to that application. I'd like to point out that while the cloud-based subscription model can be supported by having browsers on mobile devices. I'm not talking about mobile web. I'm not talking about browser-based primarily. I'm referring instead with a mobile application that has the ability to display content. And that mobile application is native, and it's interoperating with the cloud where the content resides.
Right, and for the consumer, Andrew, what's the attraction to all of this is the book that you're reading on the subway home on your phone, you can continue reading at your sofa after dinner on the iPad and so forth and so on. It's really, it doesn't depend on the device itself. It's all there for you, and you can kind of pick up where you left off after you finish dinner.
Yes, I think that is one benefit, although that could be done in the ebook e-commerce model if you had downloaded the ebook to all those devices and the delivery service provided you with the capability to maintain your bookmark, which some do. It would be possible with the ebook model as well. I think the benefit here to the consumer or the reader would be the ability to look at collections of content, to be able to access that content in a more dynamic way, and certainly have an easier time going from device to device. And there are some really interesting business implications with this. I think the ability in some market segments to create multiple title offerings where you have small collections that are designed for particular customer segments is really exciting. Now, maybe that wouldn't apply to trade fiction, but it certainly would apply to those markets that I mentioned, professional information, reference, education, even children's offerings. What is exciting about offering cloud-based subscription is that there is recurring revenue. That if, in particular in the case of reference and professional information, if you are providing a subscription that has a collection of content that allows somebody to do their job really well, then they're going to buy it every year. That obviously is exciting because that will offset the ongoing costs of supporting digital content. In this case, we have server-based licensing, as we did before with the ebook model, but we also have content served by the cloud to multiple devices. Now, I don't want to get into too much detail here on caching or some of the technical aspects, but many people say, well, doesn't this require persistent connection? Do you have to be online? And the answer is not necessarily. A mobile application has the ability to cache or locally save content that has been pulled down before to allow the customer to continue to use that piece of content when they are offline. And then when they're online again, that gets refreshed. So there are some techniques to allow people to use it even if they don't have a persistent connection. More exciting is the fact that there's a single storage location. The publisher's content is in one place, not 15 places. So there's more control, the ability to manage it, the ability to update it, having content in the cloud. When I first got into digital distribution programs and online services in the reference space, I was at the University of Chicago Press, and I saw a real problem that will come to light when publishers have hundreds, if not thousands, of titles in ebook distribution in a multitude of channels and a multitude of devices. The management of that will be very difficult. So in terms of DRM, you're basically connecting access to the server. You're not putting locks around a digital object like an ebook, and that is makes it much more difficult to pirate. Of course, you can pirate anything you see on the screen, but it is much more difficult than if I actually had the ebook that gets unlocked. So I think this is an appropriate model for many market segments, perhaps not all, but those that I mentioned. The recurring revenue is very exciting from a P&L perspective. I think the idea of thinking about digital subscriptions to collections is an exciting way of thinking through new value for many of us. And I think there's less backlash to the idea of buying a subscription to an online service than these lock-and-key DRM schemes. And I believe it gives the publisher more control, and that control will allow them to control their destiny, if you will.
Right, and
again, I'm from Finitiv, and we provide both strategy services and technology product implementation. You'll hear more about our cloud-based solutions if you come to the Publishing Business Show in March in New York, where all the details will be disclosed. Thanks very much, Chris.
Well, thank you, Andrew Brenneman, president at Finitiv, and the contact information for Andrew there on the screen right now. Andrew is the founder and president of Finitiv, and it did a great job helping us all understand what the cloud is going to mean for publishing, and we'll look forward to seeing you next late winter, at the Expo. We also have been hearing from Christoph Brehm, vice president at Attributor. My name is Chris Keneally from Copyright Clearance Center. We move now into the Q&A section of our program. We've got a number of questions already filed. We'll be getting to as many of those as we possibly can. If you have a question, please use the chat box and let us know perhaps even who it's for, if you've got a specific person. Although I think these kind of sort themselves out rather quickly, because we have, for example, For Andrew Brenneman here, a pretty simple question. It sounds like you could answer it fairly shortly. This comes to us from Kathy, and the question is this how the Adobe Content Server works? Is what Adobe doing in the cloud model?
Yeah, basically, well, Adobe Content Server provides a DRM tool set that could support, theoretically, either cloud-based or your own ebook distribution. What the content server provides is that handshake on the device, whether it is around the use of an ebook or a download or access. The device can basically make sure that the content on the device has a license associated with it. So there's a server component and a client component. The handshake is made, and it allows the content to be used. So essentially, if a publisher or distributor wanted, they could provide some of the same capabilities that you see in, say, the Kindle ecosystem themselves using those Adobe components.
Okay, and then, you know, very quickly, from Kathy as well, is are we saying here that the cloud cannot be hacked?
The cloud, any system can be hacked, definitely can be hacked. But what cannot be done quite as easily as your ebook stolen? Okay, because you're not downloading the whole thing where then you can unlock it and then copy it around. Can you hack? Sure, you can hack any system, but any system can be hardened, and from a security perspective, and after being delivering online systems for a long time, I would rather harden a server infrastructure under my management than hundreds of different devices out there in the publishing ecosystem. That's a security nightmare.
Right. Well, I want to bring Christoph Brehm back on the line. Christoph, before we get to a couple of questions from the audience, you've been hearing Andrew talk about the cloud and what it's going to mean for publishing. How does Attributor look at all of this?
Well, in terms of the cloud, it's really the question is where the original content is coming from. And, you know, one of the questions that we also see here about the difference between print titles and ebook format. And we will see how a lot of this will play out over the next few years and possibly even decades. As long as there is ebook formats and print titles out there, there will be piracy, no question. If one day we all move to the cloud-based delivery system, that this might be a better world, I do not know. But just to come back maybe to this point also about ebooks and printed format, for our clients we report separately on that and we tell them where the source of the infringement is coming from. And we currently are working on a study actually to combine the 200,000 or so titles that we have under management to get some more detailed reporting on that. The plain answer to the statistics around it is that at this point, most of the titles are still available in print format, not in ebook format yet. Hence, we also still find infringements mostly coming from hardcovers and paperbacks.
Right, right. And that's just because that's where, as you say, most of the titles still exist is in paper. But, of course, making copies of those paper books is just so much easier than it's ever been.
Just to add on to that, I just heard about a service where you can send in your book and for $3 they send you a PDF back of your book. So there you have your digitalization of your paperback book.
Absolutely. And, of course, the point of the web is that it's the world's biggest copying machine. We have a question, just a very simple one, Christoph. Does Attributor have offices in Germany? You know, you're around the world, Tokyo it mentioned and elsewhere, but why don't you tell us again where Attributor is based, or where you have your offices?
Okay, yeah, headquarters, San Mateo, California. I'm based in New York. This is where our global sales and marketing office is located. And offices in Europe, in Cologne, Germany, in Barcelona, Spain, and in London, UK. And a reseller agreement with another company in Tokyo and a presence in Australia, Sydney.
So really, really getting around the world. We have a couple of questions for Andrew Brenneman. If you have a question, we've got about 10 minutes or so left in our program. You could just let us know what the question is and perhaps who it's for by using the chat box there. Andrew, a couple of questions coming from the academic world. Erin says that she's an academic librarian, and she wonders whether the cloud model can work on a title-by-title basis. I guess that's the way that that particular library at her university prefers to make their selections for perpetual ownership. They'd rather have title-by-title selection than subscriptions.
Yes, it certainly can. Within the institutional marketplace, there are obviously delivery partners to deliver two kiosks and libraries, and that is essentially cloud-based because you're just dealing with terminals and libraries. And the librarian has the ability to select any number of titles that are in their cloud, if you will, to make available within that library. So it certainly can. And there's certainly better control than downloading your data to mobile devices.
Now, as a follow-up to that from Adrian, Andrew, is the cloud-based model different from e-book aggregators that some of us may be familiar with, such as eBrary?
Yeah, I would definitely call eBrary a cloud, an early cloud entrant. Absolutely. Now, we could say, we could look at sort of the technical aspects of eBrary. Does it have what we're looking for as a publisher or not? But I think, more importantly, eBrary is also a distributor. eBrary has a cloud. They're also a channel partner, taking a cut of their revenue for the products that they move in, primarily into the institutional marketplace. So if you want to have some autonomy, if you want to get into other markets that maybe eBrary is not, or if you don't want all of your institutional revenue coming from eBrary, you need to submit your content to multiple eBraries, right? So you might have three or four of these, eBrary, EBSCO, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of defeats the purpose of having a unified cloud. What I'm referring to in terms of cloud delivery is the cloud as a hosted platform under the control of the publisher and paid for by the publisher as a delivery cost, as opposed to being held hostage to an individual distribution partner and having all your content there. There needs to be a publisher's cloud.
Interesting point. It's, I think, an important one, Andrew. Thanks for that. Christoph, there's a question here that basically is asking, how expensive does all of this get? There's a variety of costs here. There's the cost, the revenue that's lost through piracy. There's the cost that has to be paid to chase after all these folks. Can you talk to cost and ROI on all of this?
Right, and it's a very good question. As you can imagine, I get these questions every day. And, of course, always my answer is the cost is the value that we are delivering. And we have an annual subscription model, so we wouldn't have a 95 to 98% renewal rate with our clients, if not even close to 100%, if it wasn't for the value. And I showed one of the studies that a large textbook publisher in the U.S. has done that clearly shows the return on investment. The limits of piracy on the web is a huge value from a philosophical perspective. Of course, you don't want the content to be out there for free. But the second thing is, then how many of those can I convert into customers? And that is really something that the publisher can probably answer best themselves, but at the same time, they need to use our service in the first place in order to make the judgment. But we have studies that show that, and we strongly believe that that value is there. And again, that the pricing really depends on the value that we're providing. A lot of times for clients, we do trials before we enter into a contract where we offer them to look for titles and see what the extent of piracy of their content is. And then we put case studies together, assuming that X amount of files, links are downloaded X amount of times, and you can convert X amount into actual customers. What is the return on investment? And the studies that we are more than happy to do for some of our prospective clients.
Okay, well, Christopher, thanks for that. And, you know, there are a number of questions here. We're not, unfortunately, going to be able to get to everybody's question today, but we appreciate everybody's attention throughout the program. And again, if you are interested in reviewing all this presentation, it will be available online after October 31st. But another question about pricing that I think kind of gets to the heart of the challenge of the digital age, Andrew, for publishers, is price structuring in the cloud, and particularly with around subscription-based offerings. Are we talking about very low prices per title? Do you have any sense at this point, perhaps it's still early days, but do you have any sense at this point of how publishers are pricing their subscription offerings?
That's a great question. Here's the scenario. You've got a collection of 100 titles, and you want to offer it on a subscription basis, and let's say the market will bear, $200 a year max. Now, if you apply a classic title-based P&L, it looks like you're selling books for $2 a title, right? The reality is, of course, you're doing something very different. You're providing it within the collection, and it's recurring revenue, et cetera, et cetera. But let's look at that $2. You look at the $2 and you say, you know, there's no way that we can make GM our gross margin targets for that title. This is crazy. Well, the reality is the goal is not necessarily just making a certain gross margin target that you're used to. The goal is getting the customer share. In other words, if there is someone out there that is spending $200 a year on content, the challenge is figuring out a value proposition where we can profitably deliver a service or a product and get that $200. Now, perhaps you need to have a model in which your newer titles might be delivered in standard title-based channels, paper, cloth, and ebook for a period of time, say 3 years, and then it would go into collection for incremental revenue stream. But I think we kind of have a problem in publishing of inside-out thinking financially, and we need to think more about the customer and building up a revenue model based on customer share and not just the gross margin targets that we wanted in the old world.
Well, thank you for that. And with that answer, I'm going to wrap things up here. We've enjoyed having our panelists today. That was Andrew Brenneman. He is founder and president of Finitiv Corporation, coming to us today from San Mateo, California. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Chris. And if there are any other questions that are cloud-related, I welcome all dialogue and inquiries.
Right. And your email address, if anyone wants to get in touch with you directly, is pretty simple. It's andrew@finitiv.com. I also want to thank our opening panelist, Christoph Brehm, vice president at Attributor. And, Christoph, thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you, Chris, for having me on. And same thing as with Andrew. Feel free to reach out to me at any time.
Right. Christoph's email address is Christoph, @attributed.com. Again, great email addresses, easy enough to recall. I also want to thank everybody involved with the Publishing Business Virtual Expo for working with us on this program today. We called it DRM, the Do's, Don'ts, and Profitable Strategies for Digital Rights Management. If you would like to check out, we urge you to check out the agenda for the rest of the day today. If you're interested in discussing anything you've heard in today's presentation, you can visit the Networking Lounge to chat live with other session attendees, perhaps share some thoughts about what you've just heard from Christoph and Andrew. You can also visit the Info Booth to fill out a show survey. We'd love to hear what you thought of our program. A number of other great live sessions are lined up for the rest of the afternoon, and there are a few already on demand. We encourage you to view as many as you can. And on behalf of everybody at Publishing Business, my name is Chris Keneally, Director of Business Development for Copyright Clearance Center. Thank you again for joining us today.